string to the back of your shirt and fly you like a kite? Otherwise, if I had to bet on whether you or Milo would live longer, I'd put my money on the dog. I came down with pneumonia just after Thanksgiving, okay? When I didn't improve after a couple of weeks in the hospital, the doctor told my mom I was probably going to die, and she ought to, you know, get ready for that. But he didn't tell her in your hearing, I thought. They'd never have a conversation like that in your hearing. I hung in, though, he said this with some pride. My grandfather called my mom. I think it was the first time they'd talked in a long time. I don't know who told him what was going on, but he has people everywhere. Could have been any of them. People everywhere sounded kind of paranoid, but I kept my mouth shut. Later I found that it wasn't paranoid at all. Mike's grandfather did have them everywhere, and they all saluted Jesus, the flag, and the NRA, although possibly not in that order. Grandpa said I got over the pneumonia because of God's will. Mom said he was full of bullshit, just like when he said me having DMD in the first place was God's punishment. She said I was just one tough little son of a bitch, and God had nothing to do with it. Then she hung up on him. Mike might have heard her end of the conversation, but not Grandpa's. And I doubted like hell if his mother had told him. I didn't think he was making it up, though. I found myself hoping Annie wouldn't hurry back. This wasn't like listening to Madame Fortuna. What she had, I believed, and still do all these years later, was some small bit of authentic psychic ability, amped up by a shrewd understanding of human nature and then packaged in glittering, carny bullshit. Mike's thing was clearer, simpler, purer. It wasn't like seeing the ghost of Linda Gray, but it was akin to that, okay? It was touching another world. Mom said she'd never come back here, but here we are. Because I wanted to come to the beach, and because I wanted to fly a kite, and because I'm never going to make 12, let alone my early 20s. It was pneumonia, see? I get steroids and they help, but the pneumonia combined with the Duchenne's MD fucked up my lungs and heart permanently. He looked at me with a child's defiance, watching for how I'd react to what is now so coyly referred to as the F-bomb. I didn't react, of course. I was too busy processing the sense to worry about his choice of words. So, I said, I guess what you're saying is an extra fruit smoothie won't help. He threw back his head and laughed. The laughter turned into the worst coughing fit yet. Alarmed, I went to him and pounded his back, but gently. It felt as if there was nothing under there but chicken bones. Milo barked once and put his paw up on one of Mike's wasted legs. There were two pitchers on the table, water in one and fresh squeezed orange juice in the other. Mike pointed to the water, and I poured him half a glass. When I tried to hold it for him, he gave me an impatient look, even with his coughing fit still racking him, and took it himself. He spilled some on his shirt, but most of it went down his throat, and the coughing eased. That was a bad one, he said, patting his chest. My heart's going like a bastard. Don't tell my mother. Jesus, kid, like she doesn't know. She knows too much. That's what I think, Mike said. She knows I might have 3 more good months, and then 4 or 5 really bad ones. Like in bed all the time, not able to do anything but suck oxygen and watch MASH and Fat Albert. The only question is whether or not she'll let Grammy and Grandpa Ross come to the funeral. He'd coughed hard enough to make his eyes water, but I didn't mistake that for tears. He was bleak, but in control. Last evening when the kite went up and he felt it tugging the twine, he had been younger than his age. Now, I was watching him struggle to be a lot older. The scary thing was how well he was succeeding. His eyes met mine dead on. She knows. She just doesn't know that I know. The back door banged. We looked and saw Annie crossing the patio, heading for the boardwalk. Why would I need to know, Mike? He shook his head. I don't have any idea, but you can't talk about it to Mom, okay? It just upsets her. I'm all she's got. He said his last, not with pride, but with a kind of gloomy realism. All right. Oh, one other thing, I almost forgot. He shot a glance at her, saw she was only halfway down the boardwalk, and turned back to me. It's not white. What's not white? Mike Ross looked mystified. No idea. When I woke up this morning, I remembered you were coming for smoothies, and that came into my head. I thought you'd know. Annie arrived. She had poured a mini smoothie into a juice glass. On top was a single strawberry. Yum, Mike said. Thanks, Mom. You're very welcome, hon. She eyed his wet shirt but didn't mention it. When she asked me if I wanted some more juice, Mike winked at me. I said more juice would be great. While she poured, Mike fed Milo 2 heaping spoonfuls of his smoothie. She turned back to him and looked at the smoothie glass, now half empty. Wow, you really were hungry. Told you. What were you and Mr. Jones, Devin, talking about? Nothing much, Mike said. He's been sad, but he's better now. I said nothing, but I could feel heat rising in my cheeks. When I dared to look at Annie, she was smiling. Welcome to Mike's world, Devin, she said, and I must have looked like I had swallowed a goldfish because she burst out laughing. It was a nice sound. That evening, when I walked back from Joyland, she was standing at the end of the boardwalk waiting for me. It was the first time I had seen her in a blouse and skirt, and she was alone. That was the first, too. Devin, got a second? Sure, I said, angling up the sandy slope to her. Where's Mike? He has physical therapy 3 times a week. Usually Janice, she's his therapist, comes in the morning, but I arranged for her to come this evening instead because I wanted to speak to you alone. Does Mike know that? Annie smiled ruefully. Probably. Mike knows far more than he should. I won't ask what you two talked about after he got rid of me this morning, but I'm guessing that his insights come as no surprise to you. He told me why he's in a wheelchair, that's all. And he mentioned he had pneumonia last Thanksgiving. I wanted to thank you for the kite, Dev. My son has very restless nights. He's not in pain exactly, but he has trouble breathing when he's asleep. It's like apnea. He has to sleep in a semi-sitting position, and that doesn't help. Sometimes he stops breathing completely, and when he does, an alarm goes off and wakes him up. Only last night after the kite, he slept right through. I even went in once around 2 a.m. to make sure the monitor wasn't malfunctioning. He was sleeping like a dream. No restless tossing and turning, no nightmares, he's prone to them, and no moaning. It was the kite. It satisfied him in a way nothing else possibly could, except maybe going to that damned amusement park of yours, which is completely out of the question. She stopped and then smiled. Oh, shit. I'm making a speech. It's all right, I said. It's just that I've had so few people to talk to. I have housekeeping help, a very nice woman from Heaven's Bay, and of course there's Janice, but it's not the same. She took a deep breath. Here's the other part. I was rude to you on several occasions and with no cause. I'm sorry. Shit. Annie, you don't have anything to apologize for. Yes, I do. You could have just walked on when you saw me struggling with the kite, and then Mike wouldn't have gotten that good night's rest. All I can say is that I have problems trusting people. This is where she invites me in for supper, I thought. But she didn't. Maybe because of what I said next. You know, he could come to the park. It'd be easy to arrange, and with it closed and all, he could have the run of the place. Her face closed up hard, like a hand into a fist. Oh, no. Absolutely not. If you think that, he didn't tell you as much about his condition as I thought he did. Please don't mention it to him. In fact, I have to insist. All right, I said, but if you change your mind... I trailed off. She wasn't going to change her mind. She looked at her watch, and a new smile lit her face. It was so brilliant you could almost overlook how it never reached her eyes. Oh, boy, look how late it's getting. Mike will be hungry after his pee, and I haven't done a thing about supper. Will you excuse me? Sure. I stood there watching her hurry back down the boardwalk to the Green Victorian, the one I was probably never going to see the inside of, thanks to my big mouth. But the idea of taking Mike through Joyland had seemed so right. During the summer, we had groups of kids with all sorts of problems and disabilities. Crippled kids, blind kids, cancer kids, kids who were mentally challenged, what we called retarded back in the unenlightened 70s. It wasn't as though I expected to stick Mike in the front car of the delirium shaker and then blast him off. Even if the shaker hadn't been buttoned up for the winter, I'm not a total idiot. But the merry-go-round was still operational, and surely he could ride that. Ditto the train that ran through the Wiggle Waggle Village. I was sure Fred Dean wouldn't mind me touring the kid through Mysterio's Mirror Mansion either, but no. No. He was her delicate hothouse flower, and she intended to keep it that way. The thing with the kite had just been an aberration, and the apology, a bitter pill she felt she had to swallow. Still, I couldn't help admiring how quick and lithe she was, moving with a grace her son would never know. I watched her bare legs under the hem of her skirt and thought about Wendy Keegan not at all. I had the weekend free, and you know what happened. I guess the idea that it always rains on the weekends must be an illusion, but it sure doesn't seem like one. Ask any working stiff who ever planned to go camping or fishing on his days off. Well, there was always Tolkien. I was sitting in my chair by the window on a Saturday afternoon, moving ever deeper into the mountains of Mordor with Frodo and Sam when Mrs. Shoplaw knocked on the door and asked if I'd like to come down to the parlor and play Scrabble with her and Tina Ackerley. I am not at all crazy about Scrabble, having suffered many humiliations at the hands of my aunts Tansy and Naomi, who each have a huge mental vocabulary of what I still think of as Scrabble shit words like sook, trank, and boot, an Indian ghost, should you wonder. Nevertheless, I said I'd love to play. Mrs. Shoplaw was my landlady, after all, and diplomacy takes many forms. On our way downstairs, she confided, "We're helping Tina bone up. She's quite the Scrabble shark. She's entered in some sort of tournament in Atlantic City next weekend. I believe there's a cash prize." It didn't take long, maybe four turns, to discover that our resident librarian could have given my aunts all the game they could handle, and more. By the time Miss Ackerley laid down nobility with the apologetic smile all Scrabble sharks seemed to have, I think they must practice it in front of their mirrors, Emelina Shoplaw was 80 points behind. As for me, well, never mind. "I don't suppose either of you know anything about Annie and Mike Ross, do you?" I asked during a break in the action. Both women seemed to feel a need to study the board a long time before laying down so much as a single tile. "They live on Beach Row in the big green Victorian?" Miss Ackerley paused with her hands still inside the little brown bag of letters. Her eyes were big, and her thick lenses made them even bigger.
"Have you met them?"
"Uh-huh. They were trying to fly a kite. Well, she was, and I helped out a little. They were very nice. I just wondered, the two of them all alone in that big house, and him pretty sick." The look they exchanged was pure incredulity, and I started to wish I hadn't raised the subject.
"She talks to you?" Mrs. Shoplaw asked. "The Ice Queen actually talks to you?"
Not only talked to me, but gave me a fruit smoothie, thanked me, even apologized to me. But I said none of that. Not because Annie had really iced up when I presumed too much, but because to do so would have seemed disloyal somehow. "Well, a little. I got the kite up for him. That's all."
I turned the board. It was Tina's, the pro kind with its own built-in little spindle.
"Come on, Mrs. S. Your turn. Maybe you'll even make a word that's in my puny vocabulary."
"Given the correct positioning, puny can be worth 70 points, Tina Ackerley said. "Even more if a Y word is connected to pun."
Mrs. Shoplaw ignored both the board and the advice.
"You know who her father is, of course."
"Can't say I do, although I did know she was on the outs with him in big time."
"Buddy Ross, as in the Buddy Ross Hour of Power, ring any bells?"
It did. Vaguely, I thought I might have heard some preacher named Ross on the radio in the costume shop. Kind of made sense. During one of my quick change transformations into Howie, Dottie Lassen had asked me, pretty much out of the clear blue sky, if I had found Jesus. My first impulse had been to tell her I didn't know that he was lost, but I restrained it.
"One of those Bible shouters, right? Next to Oral Roberts and that Jimmy Swaggart fella, he's just about the biggest of them," Mrs. S. said. "He broadcasts from this gigantic church, God's Citadel, he calls it, in Atlanta. His radio show goes out all over the country. And now he's getting more and more into TV. I don't know if the station's giving him time free or if he has to buy it. I'm sure he can afford it, especially late at night. That's when the old folks are up with their aches and pains. His shows are half miracle healings and half pleas for more love offerings."
"Guess he didn't have any luck healing his grandson," I said. Tina withdrew her hand from the letter bag with nothing in it. She had forgotten about Scrabble for the time being, which was a good thing for her hapless victims. Her eyes were sparkling.
"You don't know any of this story, do you? Ordinarily, I don't believe in gossip, but..."
She dropped her voice to a confidential tone pitched just above a whisper.
"But since you've met them, I could tell you."
"Yes, please," I said. I thought one of my questions, how Annie and Mike came to be living in a huge house on one of North Carolina's ritziest beaches,
had already been answered. It was Grandpa Buddy's summer retreat, bought and paid for with love offerings.
"He's got two sons," Tina said. "They're both high in his church, deacons or assistant pastors. I don't know what they call them exactly because I don't go for that holy rolling stuff. The daughter, though, she was different. A sporty type. Horseback riding, tennis, archery, deer hunting with her father. Quite a bit of competition shooting. All that got in the papers after her trouble started."
Now the Camp Perry shirt made sense.
"Around the time she turned 18, it all went to hell, quite literally, as he saw it. She went to what they call a secular humanist college, and by all accounts, she was quite the wild child. Giving up the shooting competitions and tennis tournaments was one thing. Giving up the church going for parties and liquor and men was quite another. Also," Tina lowered her voice, "pot smoking." "Gosh," I said, "not that."
Mrs. Shoplaw gave me a look, but Tina didn't notice.
"Yes, that. She got in the newspapers too, those tabloids, because she was pretty and rich, but mostly because of her father. And being fallen away, that's what they call it. She was a scandal to that church of his, wearing mini skirts and going braless and all. Well, you know what those fundamentalists preach is straight out of the Old Testament. All that about the righteous being rewarded and sinners being punished even unto the seventh generation. And she did more than hit the party circuit down there in Greenwich Village." Tina's eyes were so huge they looked on the verge of tumbling from their sockets and rolling down her cheeks.
"She quit the NRA and joined the American Atheist Society."
"Ah, and did that get in the papers?"
"Did it ever.
Then she got pregnant, no surprise there, and when the baby turned out to have some sort of problem, cerebral palsy, I think,
muscular dystrophy,
whatever it is, her father was asked about it on one of his crusade things, and do you know what he said?"
I shook my head, but thought I could make a pretty good guess.
"He said that God punishes the unbeliever and the sinner. He said his daughter was no different, and maybe her son's affliction would bring her back to God."
"I don't think it's happened yet," I said. I was thinking of the Jesus kite.
"I can't understand why people use religion to hurt each other when there's already so much pain in the world," Mrs. Shoplaw said. "Religion is supposed to comfort."
"He's just a self-righteous old prig," Tina said. "No matter how many men she might have been with or how many joints of pot she might have smoked, she's still his daughter. And the child is still his grandson. I've seen that boy in town once or twice, either in a wheelchair or tottering along in those cruel braces he has to wear if he wants to walk. He seems like a perfectly nice boy. And she was sober, also wearing a bra."
She paused for further recollection.
"I think."
"Her father might change," Mrs. Shoplaw said, "but I doubt it. Young women and young men grow up, but old women and old men just grow older and sure they've got the right on their side, especially if they know scripture."
I remembered something my mother used to say. "The devil can quote scripture."
"And in a pleasing voice," Mrs. Shoplaw agreed moodily. Then she brightened. "Still, if the Reverend Ross has let them use his place on Beach Row, maybe he's willing to let bygones be bygones. It might have crossed his mind by now that she was only a young girl, maybe not even old enough to vote. Dev, isn't it your turn?"
It was. I made tear and netted me 4 points. My drubbing wasn't merciful, but once Tina Ackerley really got rocking, it was relatively quick. I returned to my room, sat in my chair by the window, and tried to rejoin Frodo and Sam on the road to Mount Doom. I couldn't do it. I closed the book and stared out through the rain-wavery glass at the empty beach and the gray ocean beyond. It was a lonely prospect, and at times like that, my thoughts had a way of turning back to Wendy, wondering where she was, what she was doing, and who she was with. Thinking about her smile, the way her hair fell against her cheek, the soft rise of her breasts in one of her seemingly endless supply of cardigan sweaters. Not today. Instead of Wendy, I found myself thinking of Annie Ross and realizing I had developed a small but powerful crush on her. The fact that nothing could come of it, she had to be 10 years older than me, maybe 12, only seemed to make things worse. Or maybe I mean better, because unrequited love does have its attractions for young men. Mrs. S. had suggested that Annie's holier-than-thou father might be willing to let bygones be bygones, and I thought she might have something there. I'd heard that grandchildren had a way of softening stiff necks, and he might want to get to know the boy while there was still time. He could have found out, from the people he had everywhere, that Mike was smart as well as crippled. It was even possible he'd heard rumors that Mike had what Madame Fortuna called the sight. Or maybe all that was too rosy. Maybe Mr. Fire and Brimstone had given her the use of the house in exchange for a promise that she'd keep her mouth shut and not brew up any fresh pot and miniskirt scandals while he was making the crucial transition from radio to television. I could speculate until the cloud-masked sun went down and not be sure of anything on Buddy Ross's account, but I thought I could be sure about one thing on Annie's. She was not ready to let bygones be bygones. I got up and trotted downstairs to the parlor, fishing a scrap of paper with a phone number on it out of my wallet as I went. I could hear Tina and Mrs. S. in the kitchen, chattering away happily. I called Erin Cook's dorm, not expecting to get her on a Saturday afternoon. She was probably down in New Jersey with Tom, watching Rutgers football and singing the Scarlet Knights fight song. But the girl on phone duty said she'd get her, and 3 minutes later, her voice was in my ear.
Dev, I was going to call you. In fact, I want to come down and see you if I can get Tom to go along. I think I can, but it wouldn't be next weekend, probably the one after.
I checked the calendar hanging on the wall and saw that would be the first weekend in October.
Have you actually found something out?
I don't know. Maybe. I love to do research, and I really got into this. I've piled up lots of background stuff for sure, but it's not like I solved the murder of Linda Gray in the college library or anything. Still, there are things I want to show you. Things that trouble me.
Trouble you why? Trouble you how?
I don't want to try to explain over the phone. If I can't persuade Tom to come down, I'll put everything in a big manila envelope and send it to you. But I think I can. He wants to see you. He just doesn't want anything to do with my little investigation. He wouldn't even look at the photos. I thought she was being awfully mysterious, but decided to let it go.
Listen, have you heard of an evangelist named Buddy Ross?
Buddy? She burst into giggles. The Buddy Ross Hour of Power? My grandma listens to that old faker all the time. He pulls goat stomachs out of people and claims they're tumors. Do you know what Pop Allen would say? Carney from Carney, I said, grinning. Right you are.
What do you know about him? And why can't you find out for yourself? Did your mother get scared by a card catalog while she was carrying you?
Not that I know of, but by the time I get off work, the Heaven's Bay Library is closed. I doubt if they've got the who's who anyway. I mean, it's only one room. It's not about him anyway. It's about his two sons. I want to know if they have any kids.
Why?
Because his daughter has one. He's a great kid, but he's dying. A pause, then,
what are you into down there now, Dev?
Meeting new people. Come on down, I'd love to see you guys again. Tell Tom we'll stay out of the funhouse. I thought that might make her laugh, but it didn't. Oh, he will. You couldn't get him within 30 yards of the place. We said our goodbyes. I wrote the length of my call on the honor sheet, then went back upstairs and sat by the window. I was feeling that strange, dull jealousy again. Why had Tom Kennedy been the one to see Linda Gray? Why him and not me?
The Heaven's Bay weekly paper came out on Thursdays, and the headline on the October 4th edition read, Joyland Employee Saves Second Life. I thought that was an exaggeration. I'll take full credit for Haley Stansfield, but only part of it for the unpleasant Eddie Parks. The rest, not neglecting a tip of the old Howie hat to Lane Hardy, belongs to Wendy Keegan, because if she hadn't broken up with me in June, I would have been in Durham, New Hampshire that fall, 700 miles from Joyland. I certainly had no idea that more life-saving was on the agenda. Premonitions like that were strictly for folks like Rosie Gold and Mike Ross. I was thinking of nothing but Aaron and Tom's upcoming visit when I arrived at the park on October 1st after another rainy weekend. It was still cloudy, but in honor of Monday, the rain had stopped. Eddie was seated on his apple box throne in front of Horror House and smoking his usual morning cigarette. I raised my hand to him. He didn't bother to raise his in return, just stomped on his butt and leaned over to raise the apple box and toss it under. I'd seen it all 50 times or more and sometimes wondered how many butts were piled up beneath the box, but this time, instead of lifting the apple box, he just went right on leaning. Was there a look of surprise on his face? I can't say.
By the time I realized something was wrong, all I could see was his faded and grease-smeared dog top as his head dropped between his knees. He kept going forward and ended up doing a complete somersault, landing on his back with his legs splayed out and his face up to the cloudy sky. And by then, the only thing on it was a knotted grimace of pain. I dropped my lunch sack, ran to him and fell on my knees beside him.
Eddie, what is it?
Tikka, he managed. For a moment, I thought he was talking about some obscure disease engendered by tick bites, but then I saw the way he was clutching the left side of his chest with his gloved right hand. The pre-Joyland version of Dev Jones would simply have yelled for help, but after 4 months of talking the talk, help never even crossed my mind. I filled my lungs, lifted my head, and screamed, "Hey, Rube!" into the damp morning air as loud as I could. The only person close enough to hear was Lane Hardy, and he came fast. The summer employees Fred Dean hired didn't have to know CPR when they signed on, but they had to learn. Thanks to the life-saving class I had taken as a teenager, I already knew. The half-dozen of us in that class had learned beside the YMCA pool, working on a dummy with the unlikely name of Herkimer Saltfish. Now I had a chance to put theory into practice for the first time, and you know what? It really wasn't that much different from the clean and jerk I'd used to pop the hot dog out of the little Stansfield girl's throat. I wasn't wearing the fur and there was no hugging involved, but it was still mostly a matter of applying hard force. I cracked 4 of the old bastard's ribs and broke 1. I can't say I'm sorry either. By the time Lane arrived, I was kneeling alongside Eddie and doing closed chest compressions, first rocking forward with my weight on the heels of my hands, and then rocking back and listening to see if he had drawn in a breath.
"Christ," Lane said. "Heart attack?"
"Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Call an ambulance." The closest phone was in the little shack beside Pop Allen's shooting gallery, his doghouse in the talk. It was locked, but Lane had the keys to the kingdom. 3 masters had opened everything in the park. He ran. I went on doing CPR, rocking back and forth, my thighs aching now, my knees barking about their long contact with the rough pavement of Joyland Avenue. After each 5 compressions, I'd slow count to 3, listening for Eddie to inhale, but there was nothing. No joy in Joyland. Not for Eddie. Not after the first 5. Not after the second 5. Not after a half a dozen 5s. He just lay there with his gloved hands at his sides and his mouth open. Eddie fucking Parks. I stared down at him as Lane came sprinting back, shouting that the ambulance was on its way. "I'm not doing it," I thought. "I'll be damned if I'll do it." Then I leaned forward, doing another compression on the way, and pressed my mouth to his. It wasn't as bad as I feared. It was worse. His lips were bitter with the taste of cigarettes, and there was the stink of something else in his mouth. God help me, I think it was jalapeno peppers. Maybe from a breakfast omelet. I got a good seal, though. Pinched his nostrils shut and breathed down his throat. I did that 5 or 6 times before he started breathing on his own again. I stopped the compressions to see what would happen, and he kept going. Hell must have been full that day. That's all I can figure. I rolled him onto his side in case he vomited. Lane stood beside me with a hand on my shoulder. Shortly after that, we heard the wail of an approaching siren. Lane hurried to meet them at the gate and direct them. Once he was gone, I found myself looking at the snarling green monster faces decorating the facade of Horror House. "Come in if you dare," was written above the faces in drippy green letters. I found myself thinking again of Linda Gray, who had gone in alive and had been carried out hours later, cold and dead. I think my mind went to that because Aaron was coming with information, information that troubled her. I also thought of the girl's killer.
"Could have been you," Mrs. Shoplaw had said. "Except you're dark-haired instead of blonde and don't have a bird's head tattooed on one of your hands."
"This guy did. An eagle or maybe a hawk."
Eddie's hair was a premature gray of the lifelong heavy smoker, but it could have been blonde 4 years ago. And he always wore gloves. Surely he was too old to have been the man who had accompanied Linda Gray on her last dark ride. Surely, but... The ambulance was very close, but not quite here. Although I could see Lane at the gate waving his hands over his head, making hurry-up gestures. Thinking what the hell, I stripped off Eddie's gloves. His fingers were lacy with dead skin, the backs of his hands red beneath a thick layer of some sort of white cream. There were no tattoos, just psoriasis. As soon as he was loaded up and the ambulance was heading back to the tiny Heavens Bay hospital, I went into the nearest Doniger and rinsed my mouth again and again. It was a long time before I could get rid of the taste of those damn jalapeno peppers, and I've never touched one since. When I came out, Lane Hardy was standing by the door.
"That was something," he said. "You brought him back."
"He won't be out of the woods for a while, and there might be brain damage." "Maybe yes, maybe no. But if you hadn't been there, he'd have been in the woods permanently.
First a little girl, now the dirty old man. I might start calling you Jesus instead of Jonesy, because you sure are the savior."
"You do that and I'm DS." That was the talk for down south, which in turn meant turning in your time card for good.
"Okay, but you did all right, Jonesy. In fact, I gotta say you rocked the house."
"The taste of him," I said. "God."
"Yeah, I bet. But look on the bright side. With him gone, you're free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty you're free at last. I think you'll like it better that way, don't you?"
I certainly did. From his back pocket, Lane drew out a pair of rawhide gloves. Eddie's gloves.
"Found these lying on the ground. Why'd you take them off of him?"
I wanted to let his hands breathe. That sounded primo stupid, but the truth would have sounded even stupider. I couldn't believe I'd entertain the notion of Eddie Parks being Linda Gray's killer for even a moment. When I took my life-saving course, they told us that heart attack victims need all the free skin they can get. It helps somehow. I shrugged. It's supposed to, at least.
"Huh. You learn a new thing every day." He flapped the gloves. "I don't think Eddie's going to be back for a long time, if at all. So you might as well stick these in his doghouse, yeah?"
"Okay," I said. And that's what I did. But later that day, I went and got them again. Something else, too. I didn't like him. We're straight on that, right? He'd given me no reason to like him. He had, so far as I knew, given not one single Joyland employee a reason to like him. Even old-timers like Rosie Gold and Pop Allen gave him a wide berth. Nevertheless, I found myself entering the Heavens Bay Community Hospital that afternoon at 4 o'clock and asking if Edward Parks could have a visitor. I had his gloves in one hand, along with the something else. The blue-haired volunteer receptionist went through her paperwork twice, shaking her head, and I was starting to think Eddie had died after all when she said,
"Ah, it's Edwin, not Edward. He's in room 315, that's ICU, so you have to check at the nurse's station first."
I thanked her and went to the elevator, one of those huge ones big enough to admit a gurney. It was slower than old cold death, which gave me plenty of time to wonder what I was doing here. If Eddie needed a visit from a park employee, it should have been Fred Dean, not me, because Fred was the guy in charge that fall. Yet, here I was. They probably wouldn't let me see him anyway. But after checking his chart, the head nurse gave me the okay.
"He may be sleeping, though."
"Any idea about his..." I tapped my head.
"Mental function? Well, he was able to give us his name."
That sounded hopeful. He was indeed asleep. With his eyes shut and that day's late-arriving sun shining on his face, the idea that he might have been Linda Gray's date a mere 4 years ago was even more ludicrous. He looked at least 100, maybe 120. I saw I needn't have brought his gloves either. Someone had bandaged his hands, probably after treating the psoriasis with something a little more powerful than whatever OTC cream he had been using on them. Looking at those bulky white mittens made me feel a queer, reluctant pity. I crossed the room as quietly as I could and put the gloves in the closet with the clothes he had been wearing when he was brought in. That left me with the other thing, a photograph that had been pinned to the wall of his cluttered, tobacco-smelling little shack next to a yellowing calendar that was 2 years out of date. The photo showed Eddie and a plain-faced woman standing in the weedy front yard of an anonymous tract house. Eddie looked about 25. He had his arm around the woman. She was smiling at him. And wonder of wonders, he was smiling back. There was a rolling table beside his bed with a plastic pitcher and a glass on it. This I thought rather stupid. With his hands bandaged the way they were, he wasn't going to be pouring anything for a while. Still, the pitcher could serve one useful purpose. I propped the photo against it so he'd see it when he woke up. With that done, I started for the door. I was almost there when he spoke in a whispery voice. It was a long way from his usual ill-tempered rasp.
"Kiddo?"
I returned, not eagerly, to his bedside. There was a chair in the corner, but I had no intention of pulling it over and sitting down. How you feeling, Eddie?
Can't really say. Hard to breathe. They got me all taped up.
I brought you your gloves, but I see they already... I nodded at his bandaged hands.
Yeah.
He sucked in air.
If anything good comes out of this, maybe they fix them up. Fucking itch all the time, they do.
He looked at the picture.
Why'd you bring that? And what were you doing in my doghouse?
Lane told me to put your gloves in there. I did, but then I thought you might want them, and you might want the picture. Maybe she's someone you'd want Fred Dean to call.
Kareem?
He snorted.
She's been dead for 20 years. Pour me some water, kiddo. I'm as dry as 10-year dog shit.
I poured and held a glass for him, and even wiped the corner of his mouth with the sheet when he dribbled. It was all a lot more intimate than I wanted, but it didn't seem so bad when I remembered that I'd been soul-kissing the miserable bastard only hours before. He didn't thank me, but when did he ever? What he said was,
"Hold that picture up."
I did as he asked. He looked at it fixedly for several seconds and sighed.
"Miserable, scalding, backbiting cunt. Walking out on her for Royal American shows was the smartest thing I ever did."
A tear trembled at the corner of his left eye, hesitated, then rolled down his cheek. "Want me to take it back and pin it up in your doghouse, Eddie?"
"No, might as well leave it. We had a kid, you know, a little gal."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah. She got hit by a car. 3 years old she was and died like a dog in the street. That miserable cunt was yakking on the phone instead of watching her."
He turned his head aside and closed his eyes.
"Go on. Get out of here. Hurts to talk. And I'm tired. Got an elephant sitting on my chest."
"Okay. Take care of yourself." He grimaced without opening his eyes.
"That's a laugh. How exactly am I supposed to do that? You got any ideas? Because I haven't. I got no relatives, no friends, no savings, no insurance. What am I gonna do now?"
"It'll work out," I said lamely.
"Sure. In the movies it always does. Go on. Get lost."
This time I was all the way out the door before he spoke again.
"You sure let me die, kiddo."
He said it without melodrama, just a passing observation.
"I could have been with my little girl."
When I walked back into the hospital lobby, I stopped dead, at first not sure I was seeing who I thought I was seeing. But it was her, all right, with one of her endless series of arduous novels open in front of her. This one called The Dissertation. "Annie?" She looked up, at first weary, then smiling as she recognized me.
"Dev, what are you doing here?"
"Visiting a guy from the park. He had a heart attack today."
"Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Is he going to be all right?"
She didn't invite me to sit down next to her, but I did anyway. My visit to Eddie had upset me in ways I didn't understand, and my nerves were jangling. It wasn't unhappiness, and it wasn't sorrow. It was a queer, unfocused anger that had something to do with the foul taste of jalapeno peppers that still seemed to linger in my mouth. And with Wendy, God knew why. It was wearying to know that I wasn't over her, even yet. A broken arm would have healed quicker. I don't know. I didn't talk to a doctor. "Is Mike all right?" "Yes, it's just a regularly scheduled appointment. A chest x-ray and a complete blood count. Because of the pneumonia, you know. Thank God he's over it now. Except for that lingering cough, Mike's fine." She was still holding her book open, which probably meant she wanted me to go, and that made me angrier. You have to remember that was the year that everyone wanted me to go. Even the guy whose life I'd saved. Which is probably why I said, "Mike doesn't think he's fine, so who am I supposed to believe here, Annie?" Her eyes widened with surprise, then grew distant. "I'm sure I don't care who or what you believe, Devin. It's really not any of your business." "Yes, it is." That came from behind us. Mike had rolled up in his chair. It wasn't the motorized kind, which meant he had been turning the wheels with his hands. "Strong boy, cough or no cough." He had buttoned his shirt wrong, though. Annie turned to him, surprised. "What are you doing here? You were supposed to let the nurse..." "I told her I could do it on my own, and she said okay. It's just a left and two rights from radiology, you know. I'm not blind, just dying."
Mr. Jones was visiting a friend of his, Mike. So now I had been demoted back to Mr. Jones. She closed her book with a snap and stood up. He's probably anxious to get home, and I'm sure you must be I want him to take us to the park. Mike spoke calmly enough, but his voice was loud enough to make people look around. Us. Mike, you know that's not to Joyland. To Joyland. Still calm, but louder still. Now everyone was looking. Annie's cheeks were flaming. I want you both to take me. His voice rose louder still. I want you to take me to Joyland before I die. Her hand covered her mouth. Her eyes were huge. Her words, when they came, were muffled but understandable. Mike, you're not going to die. Who told you? She turned on me. Do I have you to thank for putting that idea in his head? Of course not. I was very conscious that our audience was growing. It now included a couple of nurses and a doctor in blue scrubs and booties, but I didn't care. I was still angry. He told me. Why would that surprise you when you know all about his intuitions? That was my afternoon for provoking tears. First Eddie, now Annie. Mike was dry-eyed, though, and he looked every bit as furious as I felt. But he said nothing as she grabbed the handles of his wheelchair, spun it around, and drove it at the door. I thought she was going to crash into them, but the magic eye got them open just in time. Let them go, I thought. But I was tired of letting women go. I was tired of just letting things happen to me and then feeling bad about them. A nurse approached me. Is everything all right? No, I said, and followed them out. Annie had parked in the lot adjacent to the hospital where a sign announced, "These two rows reserved for the handicapped." She had a van, I saw, with plenty of room for the folded-up wheelchair in the back. She had gotten the passenger door open, but Mike was refusing to get out of the chair. He was gripping the handles with all his strength, his hands dead white. "Get in," she shouted at him. Mike shook his head, not looking at her. "Get in, damn it!" This time, he didn't even bother to shake his head. She grabbed him and yanked. The wheelchair had its brake on and tipped forward. I grabbed it just in time to keep it from going over and spilling them both into the open door of the van. Annie's hair had fallen into her face, and the eyes peering through it were wild, the eyes almost of a skittish horse in a thunderstorm. "Let go! This is all your fault. I never should have..." "Stop!" I said. I took hold of her shoulders. The hollows there were deep, the bones close to the surface, I thought. She'd been too busy stuffing calories into him to worry about herself. "Let me go! I don't want to take him away from you," I said. "Annie, that's the last thing I want." She stopped struggling. Warily, I let go of her. The novel she had been reading had fallen to the pavement in the struggle. I bent down, picked it up, and put it into the pocket of the back of the wheelchair. "Mom," Mike took her hand, "it doesn't have to be the last good time." Then I understood. Even before her shoulders slumped and the sob started, I understood. It wasn't the fear that I'd stick him on some crazy fast ride and that the burst of adrenaline would kill him. It wasn't the fear that a stranger would steal the damaged heart she loved so well. It was a kind of atavistic belief, a mother's belief, that if they never started doing certain last things, life would go on as it had. Morning smoothies at the end of the boardwalk, evenings with the kite at the end of the boardwalk, all of it in a kind of endless summer. Only it was October now and the beach was deserted. The happy screams of teenagers in the thunderball and the little kids shooting down the splash and crash water slide had ceased. There was a nip in the air as the days drew down. No summer is endless. She put her hands over her face and sat down in the passenger seat of the van. It was too high for her, and she almost slid off. I caught her and steadied her. I don't think she noticed. "Go on. Take him," she said. "I don't give a fuck. Take him parachute jumping if you want. Just don't expect me to be a part of your boy's adventure." Mike said, "I can't go without you." That got her to drop her hands and look at him. "Michael, you're all I've got. Do you understand that?" "Yes," he said. He took one of her hands in both of his. "And you're all I've got." I could see by her face that the idea had never crossed her mind. Not really. "Help me get in," Mike said. "Both of you, please." When he was settled,
I don't remember fastening his seatbelt, so maybe this was before they were a big deal. I closed the door and walked around the nose of the van with her. "His chair," she said distractedly. "I've got to get his chair." "I'll put it in. You sit behind the wheel and get yourself ready to drive. Take a few deep breaths." She let me help her in. I had her above the elbow, and I could close my whole hand around her upper arm. I thought of telling her she couldn't live on arduous novels alone and thought better of it. She had been told enough this afternoon. I folded the wheelchair and stowed it in the cargo compartment, taking longer with the job than I needed to, giving her time to compose herself. When I went back to the driver's side, I half expected to find the window rolled up, but it was still down. She had wiped her eyes and nose and pushed her hair into some semblance of order. I said, "He can't go without you, and neither can I." She spoke to me as if Mike weren't there and listening. "I'm so afraid for him all the time. He sees so much, and so much of it hurts him. That's what the nightmares are about. I know it. He's such a great kid. Why can't he just get well? Why this? Why this?" "I don't know," I said. She turned to kiss Mike's cheek. Then she turned back to me, drew in a deep, shaky breath and let it out. "So when do we go?" she asked. The Return of the King was surely not as arduous as a dissertation, but that night I couldn't have read The Cat in the Hat. After eating some canned spaghetti for supper, and largely ignoring Mrs. Shoplaw's pointed observations about how some young people seem determined to mistreat their bodies, I went up to my room and sat by the window, staring out at the dark and listening to the steady beat and retreat of the surf. I was on the verge of dozing when Mrs. S. knocked lightly on my door and said, "You got a call, Dev? It's a little boy." I went down to the parlor in a hurry because I could think of only one little boy who might call me. "Mike?" he spoke in a low voice. "My mom is sleeping. She said she was tired." "I bet she was," I said, thinking of how we ganged up on her. "I know we did," Mike said as if I had spoken the thought aloud. "We had to." "Mike, can you read minds? Are you reading mine?" "I don't really know," he said. "Sometimes I see things and hear things, that's all. And sometimes I get ideas. It was my idea to come to Grandpa's house. Mom said he'd never let us, but I knew he would. Whatever I have, the special thing, I think it came from him. He heals people, you know. I mean, sometimes he fakes it, but sometimes he really does." "Why did you call, Mike?" He grew animated. "About Joyland. Can we really ride the merry-go-round in the Ferris wheel?" "I'm pretty sure." "Shoot in the shooting gallery?" "Maybe, if your mother says so. All this stuff is contingent on your mother's approval. That means..." "I know what it means," sounding impatient. Then the child's excitement broke through again. "It is so awesome!" "None of the fast rides," I said. "Are we straight on that? For one thing, they're buttoned up for the winter. The Carolina spin was too, but with Lane Hardy's help, it wouldn't take 40 minutes to get it running again." "For another..." "Yeah, I know, my heart. The Ferris wheel will be enough for me. We can see it from the end of the boardwalk, you know. From the top, it must be like seeing the world from my kite." I smiled. "It is like that, sort of. But remember, only if your mom says you can. She's the boss." "We're going for her. She'll know when we get there." He sounded eerily sure of himself. "And it's for you, Dev. But mostly it's for the girl. She's been there too long. She wants to leave." My mouth dropped open. But there was no danger of drooling. My mouth had gone entirely dry. "How?" "Just a croak." I swallowed again. "How do you know about her?" "I don't know. But I think she's why I came. Did I tell you it's not white?" "You did. But you said you didn't know what that meant. Do you now?"
"Nope."
He began to cough. I waited it out. When it cleared, he said, "I have to go. My mom's getting up from her nap. Now she'll be up half the night reading." "Yeah?" "Yeah. I really hope she lets me go on the Ferris wheel. It's called the Carolina Spin, but people who work there just call it the Hoister. Some of them, Eddie, for instance, actually called it the Chump Hoister, but I didn't tell him that. Joyland folks have this kind of secret talk. That's part of it. The Hoister. I'll remember. Bye, Dev." The phone clicked in my ear. This time, It was Fred Dean who had the heart attack. He lay on the ramp to the Carolina Spin, his face blue and contorted. I knelt beside him and started chest compressions. When there was no result from that, I leaned forward, pinched his nostrils shut, and jammed my lips over his. Something tickled across my teeth and onto my tongue. I pulled back and saw a black tide of baby spiders pouring from his mouth. I woke up half out of bed, the covers pulled loose and wound around me in a kind of shroud, heart pumping, clawing at my own mouth. It took several seconds for me to realize that there was nothing in there. Nonetheless, I got up, went to the bathroom, and drank two glasses of water. I may have had worse dreams than the one that woke me at 3 o'clock on that Tuesday morning, but if so, I can't remember them. I remade my bed and laid back down, convinced there would be no more sleep for me that night. Yet I had almost dozed off again when it occurred to me that the big emotional scene the three of us had played out at the hospital yesterday might have been for nothing. Sure, Joylynn was happy to make special arrangements for the lame, the halt, and the blind, what are now called special needs children, during the season. But the season was over. Would the park's undoubtedly expensive insurance policy still provide coverage if something happened to Mike Ross in October? I could see Fred Dean shaking his head when I made my request and saying he was very sorry, but... It was chilly that morning, with a strong breeze, so I took my car, parking beside Lane's pickup. I was early, and ours were the only vehicles in Lot A, which was big enough to hold 500 cars. Fallen leaves tumbled across the pavement, making an insectal sound that reminded me of the spiders in my dream. Lane was sitting in a lawn chair outside Madame Fortuna's shy, which would soon be disassembled and stored for the winter, eating a bagel generously smeared with cream cheese. His derby was tilted at its usual insouciant angle, and there was a cigarette parked behind one ear. The only new thing was the denim jacket he was wearing. Another sign, had I needed one, that our Indian summer was over. Jonesy, looking lonely. Want a bagel? I got an extra. Sure, I said. Can I talk to you about something while I eat it? Come to confess your sins, have you? Take a seat, my son. He pointed to the side of the fortune-telling booth, where another couple of folded lawn chairs were leaning. Nothing sinful, I said, opening one of the chairs. I sat down and took the brown bag he was offering. But I made a promise, and now I'm afraid I might not be able to keep it. I told him about Mike and how I had convinced his mother to let him come to the park. No easy task, given her fragile emotional state. I finished with how I'd woken up in the middle of the night, convinced Fred Dean would never allow it. The only thing I didn't mention was the dream that had awakened me. So? Lane said when I'd finished. Is she a fox, the mommy? Well, yeah. Actually, she is. But that isn't the reason. He patted my shoulder and gave me a patronizing smile I could have done without. Say no more, Jonesy. Say no more. Lane, she's 10 years older than I am. Okay, and if I had a dollar for every babe I ever took out who was 10 years younger, I could buy me a steak dinner at Hanratty's in the Bay. Age is just a number, my son. Terrific. Thanks for your wisdom. Now tell me if I stepped in shit when I told the kid he could come to the park and ride the spin in the merry-go-round. You stepped in shit, he said, and my heart sank. Then he raised a finger. But? But? Have you set a date for this little field trip yet? Not exactly. I was thinking maybe Thursday? Before Aaron and Tom showed up, in other words. Thursday's no good. Friday either. Will the kid and his foxy mommy still be here next week? I guess so, but then plan on Monday or Tuesday. Why wait? For the paper. Looking at me as if I were the world's biggest idiot. Paper? The local rag. It comes out on Thursday. When your latest life-saving feat hits the front page, you're going to be Freddie Dean's fair-haired boy. Lane tossed the remains of his bagel into the nearest litter barrel. 2 points. And then raised his hands in the air as if he was framing a newspaper headline. Come to Joyland. We not only sell fun, we save lives. He smiled and tilted his derby the other way. Priceless publicity. Fred's gonna owe you one. Take it to the bank and say thanks. How would the paper even find out? I can't see Eddie Parks telling them. Although if he did, he'd probably want them to make sure the part about how I'd practically crushed his ribcage made paragraph one. He rolled his eyes. I keep forgetting what a Jonesy come lately you are to this part of the world. The only articles anybody actually reads in that cat box liner are the police beat and the ambulance calls. But ambulance calls are pretty dry. As a special favor to you, Jonesy,
I'll toddle on down to the Banner office on my lunch break and tell the Rubes all about your heroism. They'll send someone out to interview you pronto. I don't really want... Oh, gosh. A Boy Scout with a merit badge and modesty. Save it. You want the kid to get a tour of the park, right?
Yes.
Then do the interview. Also, smile pretty for the camera. Which, if I may jump ahead, is pretty much what I did. As I was folding up my chair, he said, Our Freddie Dean might have said fuck the insurance and risked it anyways, you know. He doesn't look it, but he's Carney from Carney himself. His father was a low-pitched jackjaw on the corn circuit. Freddie told me once his pop carried a Michigan bankroll big enough to choke a horse. I knew low-pitched jackjaw on corn circuit, but not Michigan bankroll. Lane laughed when I asked him. 220s on the outside, the rest either singles or cut-up green paper. Great gag when you want to attract a tip, but when it comes to Freddie himself, that ain't the point. He reset his derby yet again. What is? Carnies have a weakness for good-looking points and tight skirts and kids down on their luck. They also have a strong allergy to Rube rules, which includes all the bean counter bullshit. So maybe I wouldn't have to... He raised his hands to stop me. Better not to have to find out. Do the interview. The Banner's photographer posed me in front of the Thunderball. The picture made me wince when I saw it. I was squinting and thought I looked like the village idiot, but it did the job. The paper was on Fred's desk when I came in to see him on Friday morning. He hemmed and hawed, then okayed my request, as long as Lane promised to stick with us while the kid and his mother were in the park. Lane said okay to that with no hemming and hawing. He said he wanted to see my girlfriend and burst out laughing when I started to fulminate. Later that morning, I told Annie Ross I'd set up a tour of the park that following Tuesday morning if the weather was good, Wednesday or Thursday if it wasn't. Then I held my breath. There was a long pause, followed by a sigh. Then she said okay. That was a busy Friday. I left the park early, drove to Wilmington, and was waiting when Tom and Aaron stepped off the train. Aaron ran the length of the platform, threw herself into my arms, and kissed me on both cheeks and the tip of my nose. She made a lovely armful, but it's impossible to mistake sisterly kisses for anything other than what they are. I let her go and allowed Tom to pull me into his enthusiastic, back-thumping man-hug. It was as if we hadn't seen each other in 5 years instead of 5 weeks. I was working stiff now, and although I had put on my best chinos and sports shirt, I looked it. Even with my grease-spotted jeans and sun-faded dog top back in the closet of my room at Mrs. S's, I looked it. "It's so great to see you," Aaron said. "My God, what a tan." I shrugged. "What can I say? I'm working in the northernmost province of the Redneck Riviera." "You made the right call," Tom said. "I never would have believed it when you said you weren't going back to school, but you made the right call. Maybe I should have stayed at Joyland." He smiled that I French kissed the Blarney Stone smile of his that could charm the birdies down from the trees, but it didn't quite dispel the shadow that crossed his face. He could never have stayed at Joyland, not after our dark ride. They stayed the weekend at Mrs. Shoplaw's beachside accommodations. Mrs. S. was delighted to have them, and Tina Ackerley was delighted to see them. And all five of us had a hilarious, half-drunk picnic supper on the beach with a roaring bonfire to provide warmth. But on Saturday afternoon, when it came time for Aaron to share her troubling information with me, Tom declared his intention to whip Tina and Mrs. S. at Scrabble and send us off alone. I thought that if Annie and Mike were at the end of their boardwalk, I'd introduce Aaron to them. But the day was chilly, the wind off the ocean was downright cold, and the picnic table at the end of the boardwalk was deserted. Even the umbrella was gone, taken in and stored for the winter. At Joyland, all four parking lots were empty, save for the little fleet of service trucks. Aaron, dressed in a heavy turtleneck sweater and wool pants, carrying a slim and very businesslike briefcase with their initials embossed on it, raised her eyebrows when I produced my key ring and used the biggest key to open the gate. "So," she said, "you're one of them now." That embarrassed me. Aren't we all embarrassed, even if we don't know why, when someone says we're one of them? Not really. I carry a gate key in case I get here before anyone else, or if I'm last to leave, but only Fred and Lane have all the keys of the kingdom. She laughed as if I had said something silly.
The key to the gate is the key to the kingdom. That's what I think. Then she sobered and gave me a long, measuring stare. You look colder, Devin. I thought so even before we got off the train when I saw you waiting on the platform.